I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much, Jane, for that kind introduction. Well, this is an area that many of you know is extremely vexing and very complex because data privacy and security laws are changing constantly all over the world. So we're trying to manage both global change and this incredible uptick in the amount of data that we're receiving all the time and storing. So it is a challenging area that I would say that it's going to become ever more complex in the coming years. So hopefully today I'll give you a taste of what's going on around the world. So the topics that I'll be covering today are, we'll talk about U.S. privacy rules. I'll hit a little bit on what's going on in the EU and other international jurisdictions. We'll talk about two areas that are I think keeping a lot of our clients tied up in knots, cloud computing and also managing the management of vendors, and then I will wrap things up for you. Just to give you a sense of my perspective, where do I come from? We have in our practice about 25 privacy professionals all over the world. We realized very early on that there was no way that we could keep the practice local to the U.S. because data travels in huge volume and at great speed all over the world and can reside in 16 or 52 different jurisdictions at once. So we created a global privacy practice about a decade or so ago to manage personal information that is now sitting in many different repositories, sometimes at the same time. We represent clients across every industry sector, from financial services of interest to you, and I've listed some other sectors that we manage, but essentially all over the globe and in every industry sector, because data is data is data, no matter who holds it. There are different rules, of course, for different industries. We also have a privacy think tank associated with the firm, the Center for Information Policy Leadership, because this area is very much in flux, and we think not only of the law in this space, which is nascent at best, but also about the policy arena, which is changing constantly. We also have a blog. If you're interested in this area, I would recommend that you take a look at the blog and subscribe. We have about 1,500 or so subscribers. It's a very good blog because we post from all over the world. So we make sure that we're keeping up on all global privacy changes. So let's start with definitions. We think about privacy and data security often in the same breath, but I'd like to tease the two concepts apart a little bit. So data privacy is about the appropriate use of information, of personal data, and we define the word appropriate by looking at laws in different countries, and where there are no laws, we think about consumer expectation. What do individuals think is an appropriate use of their data? And that's a very important piece in our world because there are, as I said, really nascent regimes globally in this area, so we have to think about consumer expectation. Data security is the more objective factor. It is maintaining the confidentiality of data, maintaining its security, and also making sure that data is not used in untoward ways. When we think about risks in this area, we generally focus on four risks. The first is legal compliance. Now that's fairly black and white. It's easier said than done, of course, but it is fairly black and white. What law applies and how do you manage your data within the legal constraints? Reputational risk is a much, much harder risk to get your arms around in this area because, in fact, there are many instances and many examples where companies acted and used data in ways that were incredibly offensive to individuals or to governments or businesses, but those activities were not illegal. The activities did, in fact, land them on the front page of the paper, but they were not illegal. Investment risk is where you invest in new technologies or new databases and new businesses or services, and you find that because of privacy or data security issues, you can't actually take advantage of your investment. And reticence risk is the exact opposite. It's the flip side, where you're afraid to use data. You can bet that your competitors will be using data, and then ultimately you'll fail in your business mission. Let's move on to the U.S. In the U.S., we have a bit of a handicap because we don't even have a good definition for this term that we are focused on. We think about personal information, non-public personal information, personally identifiable information, personal data. There's lots and lots of terms that define this body of data. And, of course, you're all familiar with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act and its definitions and its coverage. You're probably also familiar with HIPAA that regulates the healthcare arena, but also regulates business associates, those who serve as service providers to healthcare entities. And then in the state breach notification laws, there's an entirely separate definition, and that personal information is defined for purposes of those laws as data that can be used to commit identity theft or account fraud. And then the FTC defines this term extremely broadly to mean any data that can identify an individual. And their definition says something like following. Any data that can be used to identify a person, such as A, name, B, address, C, telephone number, E, D, email address, et cetera, and it goes on down the line to items such as IP address, and also location information. So something like a latitude and longitude could, in fact, be deemed personal information. In the U.S., we have about a dozen privacy laws. I've listed some of the major ones here. We are deemed by Europeans to take a sectoral approach to privacy, meaning that we regulate privacy based on industry sector. Now, you all know GLB very well, and you know that it impacts financial institutions. GLB essentially has two pieces. It has the privacy rule that requires that you provide a privacy notice detailing your privacy practices, and it also requires that you provide an opt-out opportunity for the sharing of certain data. And then the second piece to GLB is the safeguards rule, which requires that entities that are covered under GLB implement a comprehensive written information security program. HIPAA affects healthcare entities and also has the same bifurcation in its coverage, separating the privacy rule from the security rule, and it's called the security rule under HIPAA, not the safeguards rule. Many of you are thinking, well, HIPAA doesn't really impact us. That has changed because business associates, so anybody who performs services for a covered healthcare entity and has access to protected health information, is actually now statutorily responsible for complying with the security rule under HIPAA. It's not just a question of signing a business associate agreement and complying with contractual obligations. The Fair Credit Reporting Act is probably the first privacy law in this country, and it required credit reporting agencies to comply with certain rules on data integrity and data accuracy. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act was also an early law, and it protects children's data that is collected online and focuses on children under the age of 13. The CAN-SPAM Act regulates the sending of commercial email. The Video Privacy Protection Act was an interesting one, and Driver's Privacy Protection Act. Both of those are very narrow laws, and they were both enacted in the wake of harms. So it was the response to various harms. For the VPPA, that was enacted after the Bork nomination to the Supreme Court, if any of you remember that, because the folks who were opposing his nomination had pulled his video rental records. And then the Driver's Privacy Protection Act was enacted in the wake of a murder where a former boyfriend of an actress had tried to figure out where she worked to find her and did, in fact, find her through her DMV records and set out and murdered her. Telephone Consumer Protection Act is the rubric under which we find the Do Not Call Registry that prohibits telemarketing to numbers that are listed in the registry. And that was probably the biggest shock to marketers in this country, because actually there are more people listed on the Do Not Call Registry than there are registered voters in this country. And the Privacy Act of 1974 is another good example of a law enacted after a harm has been committed. This was, if you think back, 1974 was the year of Watergate. So this was enacted in the wake of Watergate to try to impose some controls on records that are maintained by the federal government. Section 5 of the FTC Act, of the Federal Trade Commission Act, is the principal enforcement method in this country for enforcing against privacy and data security violations. What it does is it prohibits unfair or deceptive trade practices. The FTC really began using its Section 5 authority in the 1990s, early 2000s, and the early focus was on deceptive statements. So if you made a statement in your privacy policy that the FTC found to be deceptive, like I don't share my data with anyone, or I have in place superb security mechanisms, and those statements were found to be deceptive, the FTC could bring an action under its Section 5 authority. In the early to mid-2000s, the FTC shifted its focus and really started to focus on specific customer harms, physical harm or economic harm in particular. And we're seeing a new focus now on other harms that are not as concrete, that are much more amorphous, like harm to human dignity. So this is an evolving area. We'll see where the FTC goes next. Some of the enforcement actions they've brought involve data security, and so there are this number has risen to now over 40 cases nearly 40. There are more actions brought now constantly. The FTC was slower in the early years, and now they're very active in bringing these cases. But many of them stem from information security issues, the failure to put in place reasonable safeguards to protect data. A number of them also result from a failure to comply with a privacy assertion that was made, a representation of some sort that was made in a privacy policy or a statement posted online, for example. And others result from a failure to dispose of data properly. For example, there are some cases that were brought against companies for disposing of paper data in a way that was discoverable by a dumpster diver walking along the street, and there have been penalties imposed for that. There are a couple of more recent cases, Google, Facebook, and now MySpace, that really are sort of pure privacy actions. And what the FTC has required there is that these companies put in place a comprehensive privacy program that will be monitored by the FTC for the next 20 years. So we're moving away from the much more concrete, information security, disposing of your data properly, to the much more ephemeral of making sure that you have a comprehensive privacy program in place. I won't go through each of these bills, but I added this slide to just give you a sense of the fact that there are so many privacy bills that have been enacted over the course of the last year. That have been proposed over the course of the last year. Some of them are comprehensive. Some of them are quite narrow. And they really hit on a number of privacy topics, such as Do Not Track Act that Senator Rockefeller has proposed to allow people to opt out of being tracked online. There are some children's data proposals as well, and some data security proposals. So there is a lot happening in this space. It's very active on the legislative front. On the state side, we have a huge amount of activity. So I've tried to put the state laws into broad categories, but there really are hundreds of state privacy laws. So there are laws that require that you have a certain content or that impose penalties for failure to comply with your privacy notice. There are other laws that contain marketing restrictions, so they restrict the use of data for marketing purposes. Others that restrict the use of social security numbers. Michigan and Utah have laws that allow parents or guardians to put their children's contact points on a registry so that they will not be contacted with advertisements for adult products. there are laws dealing with radio frequency identification, with spyware, and more recently, laws that have been enacted in a few states not allowing employers to use credit reports to make employment decisions, with the thought that the economy is terrible. Lots of people have poor credit files that would not otherwise have negative files, and those people shouldn't be penalized from working because of their negative credit. On the information security side, there are a couple of categories of laws here. California's law is probably emblematic of the most laws in this country on the state side. It requires that if you maintain personal information, you have to put reasonable security measures in place, and you need to have contracts with service providers to protect information if you allow your service providers to access your data. Massachusetts has the most onerous data security requirements in the country. It is the most prescriptive of the laws, and it requires that you put in place a comprehensive written information security program to protect data. This is not dissimilar to GLB's safeguards rule. It probably looks quite similar to you. You need to put in place information security policies. You need to require that your service providers also implement security measures, and you need to embed that requirement into a contract. And then you also need to implement certain prescriptive very specific security requirements with respect to computerized data. Nevada also has a reasonably prescriptive rule, but it only covers social security numbers. It requires that social security numbers be encrypted if they are sent over the public internet. The other set of laws that you're probably quite familiar with are the security breach notification laws. There are now 49 U.S. jurisdictions, so 46 states plus the District of Columbia, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico that have requirements in place that require that you notify individuals if there's a compromise of their unencrypted computerized data. This all started in California. These laws are patterned after the Environmental Community Right to Know laws, the idea being that if you have a leak, I'll use environmental language, a leak of personal data that you notify individuals so they can take steps to protect themselves. And so that is, it's really the concept is along the same lines as the environmental laws. There are also, as many of you know, there are federal breach notification requirements in pursuant to GLB and the interagency guidance, and there also are federal breach notification rules under HIPAA. There have been a number of recent breaches that really are very significant. I'll point to a couple of them. Epsilon, for one, was very significant in that the data that was hacked in the Epsilon event was actually not data that could be used to commit account fraud or identity theft itself. It was name and email address. But because the volume of data, it was hundreds of millions of people's records, was so significant, that just landed them in a huge heap of hot water. Of course, the Sony breach was really significant because of the volume there, and the FBI also has experienced a recent hacking event, so nobody is immune. What is an information security breach? When we think about this, we think of a very, very broad range of activities. So we think from one end of the spectrum, the more innocuous types of events like a lost or stolen laptop that contains data like a social security number or financial account number or credit card number, and that needs to be reported as a security breach. To the other end of the spectrum, where you have an intentional deliberate event where the bad guys are seeking to get at data, and they will sit in systems, they can sit in systems for a year or more, pulling out millions of people's records. These events can occur both through individuals with authorized access, and of course they can also occur through hacking events, and they can result in zero harm or very, very significant harm. The rules generally require that if you have a compromise of unencrypted computerized personal information, you need to notify the individuals whose data was compromised. The data at issue in these laws is typically name plus social security number, driver's license or state ID card number, or financial account number, which means credit card or debit card number or checking or savings account. And often the laws say that you also need a password or access code, but sometimes they don't. Now, the laws do differ. There are a number of laws that add to the definition of personal information. They add things like health data or health plan information or date of birth or mother's maiden name. So there are additions in addition to the data elements I've listed here. About a dozen laws now also cover paper data, not just computerized data, so we need to think about paper as well. And also a different dozen or so requires notification to the state agencies. Under the federal interagency guidance, you need to notify your federal functional regulator, so it has the same effect. Many of the laws also require notification to the credit reporting agencies and also contain timing requirements. So there are four laws that require that you notify within 45 days of discovery, for example, but most of the laws require that you notify within the most expedient time possible and without unreasonable delay. There are also a number of laws that contain a harm threshold, so you don't need to notify unless there's some harm that is anticipated as a result of the event. And then there are also a number of laws that contain content requirements for the notification letter. So a quick sort of wrap-up slide on data breach. We talk a lot about how to manage a breach, but, of course, the best medicine is prevention. So prevent, prevent, prevent. And certainly we have found that proactive planning can minimize the impact if and when a breach occurs. I think a breach is a question of when, not a question of if. Without question, data security requires a focus from the top. It is a huge issue for companies today. And breaches, you know, if you haven't had senior buy-in before a breach happens, a breach will often result in senior-level buy-in because they involve the C-suite if they're big events. Without question, we need to reevaluate our systems on an ongoing basis. The bad guys are very sophisticated. They're good at what they do, and we need to stay one step ahead. And it is so important to integrate information security into the corporate ethos of the organization. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on around the world. Well, it looks like my previous slide, which is blank, didn't come through. That slide is a map of the world. And it shows which countries have comprehensive data protection laws in place and which have none. And it shows the U.S. as actually having none. So that's sort of an interesting tidbit. It was drafted by a European, and that is his view of the United States. So in Europe, we have a comprehensive regime rather than sectoral. We regulate privacy in Europe through the Data Protection Directive. This directive requires that all 27 member states implement law to make the directive effective in their country, and there are now 27 data protection laws that implement the directive, plus the EEA nations of Liechtenstein, Iceland, and Norway also have implemented very similar laws to the rest of the European Union. The very, very broad requirements of the directive are that entities need to register with their data protection authorities in their local jurisdictions. They need to register their processing activities. And the other very broad requirement is that data cannot be transferred, personal data can't be transferred outside of Europe or accessed outside of Europe, because that's considered a data transfer, from a country that is considered to not have adequate data protection laws in place. And the U.S. is deemed to not have adequate data protection laws in place. So in order to transfer data from the EU to the U.S. Or to Singapore or Hong Kong or any number of other jurisdictions, there needs to be a data transfer mechanism. Otherwise, it is illegal to transfer that data. There are going to be huge changes coming up. The Data Protection Directive will be replaced in around 2015 or 16 with a regulation. The regulation, the fact that it's a regulation is very significant because there will be one, there will not be 27 of them, and it will be administered out of Brussels, the heart of the European Commission. That's going to change the individual enforcement that's now being done in the member states. In addition, the provisions of the draft regulation are significantly different from what we have in the Data Protection Directive today. It's not worth a discussion at this time because it will change dramatically over the next couple of years, but it's absolutely something to keep your eye on. Where else are there data protection laws? We've got a comprehensive law in Canada. PIPEDA is the acronym used there, but watch out in Canada because there are also provincial laws that preempt the federal law. So, for example, in Alberta, in British Columbia, in Quebec, there are provincial laws, and they preempt PIPEDA. Latin America is interesting because there are, in fact, many data protection regimes now in Latin America. So we now have an older and existing law in Argentina, but we have new laws now over the last couple of years in Mexico, in Peru, in Colombia, Uruguay. So it is absolutely a place to watch, and more countries are enacting data protection laws in Latin America. And I've listed here a whole bunch of countries that have laws with data transfer restrictions, and I really do this, you know, if you just look at the top line, it's hard to believe that these countries, some of which are very minor countries, really have data protection laws in place, but they do, and they are certainly countries to watch out for if you do business in those jurisdictions. We are very closely watching China. There are some data protection laws in China. They are they're sort of dancing around the edges of data protection, but once China enacts an omnibus law, it's going to be a very big deal, I think, around the world. Let's talk about a couple of hot topics. So cloud computing is an area that has attracted a huge amount of attention lately. If you haven't been approached about moving to the cloud, you will be. If you haven't discussed this, you will discuss this. It is absolutely the way the economy is going. It makes a lot of sense to move data to a vendor who knows how to manage data a lot better than we do as individual companies and a lot more securely in most instances. But this has also raised the eyebrows of many, many people, ranging from Congress to regulators to businesses to privacy activists who are very concerned about the fact that cloud computing means that everybody's data is going to be held in one place or in 16 places, but by very few entities that are you know, essentially holding the bulk of data, of business data around the world. So there are really significant issues in connection with cloud computing that we've needed to think about in the privacy arena. Of course, data security is an absolutely pivotal issue, and there have been some instances where cloud vendors have been hacked and data has been compromised. Those are obviously very significant events to the industry as a whole, not just to the particular cloud provider, because one of the very significant issues is whether data can be maintained securely, and that's a big concern for most businesses. And if it can't be held securely, and if there are instances where it hasn't been held securely, then cloud computing will not actually be a success. Another very important question is which jurisdictions' laws apply when data is in the cloud. And what does that really mean? It means that data is moved around as needed by the cloud provider to respond to business imperatives and efficiencies. It's a distributed business model, but when there are countries with data transfer restrictions, it's not so easy to move that data, and you bump up against data transfer restrictions in various jurisdictions. So which laws apply? Is it the location where the data is sitting? Is it the location of the data owner or the data controller, using European parlance? Is it the location of the individual whose data it is? Is it the location, the main location of the cloud provider? We don't know answers to these questions yet. There was a major paper that was just issued by the Article 29 Working Party, which is the committee comprised of all European data protection authorities, issued about 2 weeks ago on cloud computing. And there is another paper about to come out in the next day or couple of days by another European body on cloud computing. So that's something to watch. Another issue that has been really at the fore is a question of what to do if law enforcement seeks access to data. In the U.S., we have ability through the Patriot Act, the FBI has the ability to request information, demand information from a cloud provider, and the cloud provider is actually not permitted to tell the data owner that that request has come in. It is a requirement of law subject to criminal sanction that the cloud provider provide the data to the FBI. That makes people really queasy. It makes them very, very nervous about the fact that data is going to be provided to law enforcement without them having the knowledge and without them being able to challenge that request for data. This is happening in jurisdictions around the world. The Indian government is extremely active in seeking data. And they have made clear to a number of our clients that if we don't turn over the data, they may show up at the door and pull the country manager down to their police headquarters. So that's never a comfortable place to be. A couple of other issues. There are a number of laws that require that if you have a service provider, you need to have a written contract in place with that service provider. So it's important to think about the restrictions that apply based on specific industry sector laws. GLB, for example, does require an agreement with service providers and requires that certain provisions be in those agreements. So this would be an example. That would be an example of a law that requires that sort of an agreement. HIPAA also requires that sort of an agreement. I mentioned information security as a topic of deep concern, but what about breaches? So in a breach situation under the state breach notification laws, a service provider is required to notify the data owner that there's been a compromise of data, and it is the data owner's responsibility to notify the individuals whose data was compromised. Now, that's a very uncomfortable position to be in, of course, because as the entity that owns the data or controls the data, you don't want to be in a position of telling your customers that, well, we housed your data, we parked your data with the service provider, and the service provider lost it or wasn't able to protect it in some way. So that's a tough challenge, and that's certainly one that makes people very nervous about putting their data in a cloud. I talked about the Patriot Act issues already. This is the authority under which the FBI can seek data from cloud providers without allowing cloud providers to tell their business customers that the data has been sought. And we really do think that in this area there is significant enforcement risk. This is on everybody's radar screen, from members of Congress to the FTC in this country, also abroad in Europe. There's a huge focus on this area, as I detailed the two papers that have or will come out within a one-month period, and other jurisdictions also are focusing on this issue. So I do believe there is significant enforcement risk, and we need to watch this area closely. So what do you do to try to manage the risk? The key is to conduct extensive due diligence on cloud providers. Make sure that they can actually protect data in the way that you think they should. Are they compliant with industry standards? Are their systems sufficiently secure? Do they have documentation to show you regarding the security of their systems? Or can they go through an extensive checklist of items with you and answer questions about the security of their systems? You also, of course, want to consider the cloud provider's reputation. That's a very important piece to the puzzle because there are some cloud providers that have built reputations on being very capable, very much able to maintain the security of data and also manage privacy issues like data transfer restrictions. And there are others that you speak to and you just sort of wonder how they've managed to get any clients at all because they have no understanding of these issues and they're really not the ones that you want to be dealing with. So reputation is very significant in this space. The legal developments are changing constantly. So not only do you need to monitor the legal developments with respect to cloud computing per se, but also monitoring legal developments that might have an impact on cloud computing, like new countries with data transfer restrictions in place. And of course, you want to make sure that in addition to doing the due diligence, that you have that you also have protections in the contract itself. So that you can hold the cloud provider to the obligations that you think they ought to abide by. In addition, I would throw in as a final item ongoing monitoring of a cloud provider because you can do initial due diligence. They may be in great shape at the beginning of your service term with them. As the contract progresses, as the term progresses, they may have new management, they may have new people in charge, and their ability to maintain the security of data may in fact be challenged or compromised down the road. So it is very important, I think, to maintain an audit right so you can go in and do ongoing monitoring as the need arises. Let's talk a little bit about vendors. Vendors present a really significant risk in this space. Probably about 60% of the data breaches that we've handled, and we've handled over 1,000 at this point, probably over 60% have been a result of service providers' inability to maintain data securely or just poor luck of having a laptop stolen, for example, from the car of an employee or a hotel room that contains data. So service providers really present a very significant risk in this area. It is critical to have a vendor management program in place to mitigate risk. Often what that means is that there is a selection process that is quite extensive and focuses on data security issues. Data privacy is less of a concern here because you have to assume, and I think this is the right assumption, but you know we have to be sure about that and put it into the contract, that the service provider is not going to use data for any purpose other than to service the business that's retaining the service provider. So it's very important to have due diligence materials in place. Those often take the form of questionnaires. Sometimes there are two parts of the questionnaire, a very simple first part A that might ask about the depth of access to personal information about individuals, and then the second one, assuming that there is access to that data, the second one could be much, much more complex and ask very deep questions about the security that the service provider can offer. We also like to see very strong contract language that addresses both compliance with law and also the specific requirements of our clients when it comes to data security. So typically the contract language with vendors will span anywhere from 3 pages to 15 that focuses only on privacy, data security, and confidentiality. And certainly, as with any good program, as I mentioned earlier with respect to cloud providers, you want to be able to do ongoing monitoring and to provide your internal auditors with a checklist of items they ought to take a look at if they want to do an audit later on. So some of the standard contractual provisions are listed here, and what we focus on is that vendors need to maintain the personally identifiable information that they have in strict confidence. They may not use it for any purpose other than to perform services for the company itself. They can only use the information on the company's behalf and for the company's benefit, and they need to comply not only with law, but in this space, industry standards are important because, again, there's really very little law compared with other areas, but also very important for them to comply with the company's privacy policies because, of course, as I mentioned, Gramm-Leach-Bliley requires that you comply with your privacy policy, and other laws require that as well, and the FTC focuses on this. If you don't comply with your privacy policy, you're in trouble, and so you have to require your service providers to do the same. We also like to see provision in service provider contracts that require that companies implement programs to protect against unauthorized access to the data, unauthorized destruction or use of the data, and unauthorized disclosure. Additional provisions would require, for example, that the vendor notify the company immediately if there's unauthorized disclosure of the data. That most vendors will seek to put some sort of reasonable time period in there, like 15 days or 30 days, but it's really important that the data owner know about this right away because sometimes they have a timing limitation. Like in HIPAA, there's a 60-day requirement to notify individuals from the time of discovery, and if your business associate doesn't notify you until day 59, you have one day to do it, and there is no leeway around that. We also want to ensure that the service provider is representing that they will not disclose the data to anyone other than a need-to-know employee or subcontractor. And then it's very important to also think about termination. What happens at the end of the day? The data is maintained by the service provider. Sometimes they actually pull the data and they've got it in their own systems. What do you want at the end of the day? And what we typically ask for is that the data be returned or destroyed. Now, the tricky thing is which data, not so much identifying the data, but the medium in which the data is maintained, because it's easy to point to the main repository. It's not so easy to point to secondary repositories where the data might have been copied into other repositories or, as is the case in many companies, there are backup tapes that are kept for some period of time. And those backup tapes also will contain data. So we want to make sure that we're accounting for the return or destruction of personal data at the end of a contract, and often we'll ask for an officer's certificate that would represent that all the personal data in the hands of the service provider have either been securely destroyed or returned to the company. And then, of course, we talked about the right to monitor a vendor's compliance. There always ought to be an audit right in these contracts. So practical tips. With respect to existing vendors, it may be very difficult to amend a contract in midstream, but certainly you want to think about what provisions are in the contract, and then if they really are paltry, it may be necessary to go back and amend those contracts. There is every expectation on the part of regulators today, every expectation that there will be significant contractual protections to protect the security of data. You also want to make sure that if a vendor has robust access to a system, that they're doing ongoing, that you're doing ongoing monitoring of that vendor. With respect to new vendors, we certainly want to see extensive due diligence on the vendor, make sure that the vendor is capable of protecting the data in the way you think the data ought to be protected. And we also want to negotiate very strong contractual protections and then, again, do ongoing monitoring. Doing the first two, due diligence and strong contractual protections, is not your get-out-of-jail-free card if you haven't also been doing ongoing monitoring of your vendor. And just to wrap this up and leave a little bit of time for questions, What can you do to manage all this? It is a very complex and changing world in the world of data privacy and data security. It is hard to wrap your arms around this area. I would suggest focusing on the four risks. It's a good way to manage this area. Now, these risks are risks that we consider in any compliance setting, so in any basic compliance program, but these are good risks to think about in the privacy and data security arena. So compliance with law, think about your reputation. If what you're planning to do is something that might sully your reputation, don't do it. Doesn't matter whether it's legal or illegal. If you are investing in a new business, in a new service, new technologies, and you find that there are uses of data that make you uncomfortable, that is an investment risk. And if you have so much data and everybody's fearful of using it, you absolutely need to watch that because your competitors will be using data. Regularly assess your practices and your policies. We have some clients that actually go back and quarterly revisit their privacy policies to make sure that they're still accurate. You know, information practices change constantly, so it is important to make sure that your information your privacy notices and privacy policies are reflective of the changing information practices of your company. Also, of course, critical to test your systems on an ongoing basis. And focus as much as you can on data security. It is a critical area for most companies today. Choosing vendors carefully goes without saying, and also proactively monitoring the legal climate that is really changing at lightning speed. Even those of us who are monitoring this 24/7 are having trouble keeping up with the changes around the world. And the last thing I'll leave you with is to be sensitive to individuals' expectations. We often ask the question around here when we're faced with a new marketing program, a promotion, a use of data that might be a little questionable. We ask each other, what would your mother think? And if the answer is, she wouldn't like it very much, then that is a signal to take a closer look and think about whether you do, in fact, want to use data in the proposed manner. And with that, I will turn to the last slide, which I'm not able to do. There it is. Whoops. With my contact information, and I'm happy to take a couple of questions.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. Lots of things to consider. And I know we don't have too much time, but I do have a quick question for you. What would you consider to be maybe the hottest topic in data privacy that might be really important for the banking community right now?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of areas to watch. I do think that GLB is very well established at this point, but there have been some forays by legislators, federal legislators, to tighten up the GLB requirements. So that's an area to watch. Certainly, we want to watch the CFPB. They are feeling their oats, and they will become active in GLB enforcement, I believe. So that's an area to watch. Other areas that are significant right now are use of mobile devices, and for the banking industry, the use of mobile devices for payment and other banking activities is just going to be, you know, huge going forward. It already is, and so we need to keep our eye on this. There's a lot going on in the mobile space, many attempts to regulate in this area because there is a recognition that this area is relatively unregulated right now. There's also a focus by the regulators on behavioral advertising. Many of our marketing groups, including at banks, do significant tracking of individuals online, and that's absolutely an area to watch. And finally, the use of, and this is by no means a complete list, this is just a very subjective list, but also important to watch the use of geolocation data. So where we're using a mobile device and we are tracking somebody's location to provide a service, that is absolutely subject to regulation, and I think we'll see a lot of activity on that front as well.